Hello, thank you for downloading this podcast of the NYU Abu Dhabi Institute. We hope you enjoy listening to this. For more information about our programs, please visit www.nyuad.nyu.edu/institute.
Welcome everyone, thank you for coming, and thank you for waiting this few minutes as we're having more people join us. So this is the last day of the program, Mother and Its Shadows, and this was an event that brought a multidisciplinary approach to understanding and reflecting on motherhood, both as a concept and reality. I'm Zainab Albarnoussi, I go by Z. I am a visiting assistant professor of social research and public policy here at NYUAD. And I will be moderating a fascinating discussion on motherhood in the public domain with these fantastic people. So first we have Dina Siddiqui, who is a clinical associate professor of global liberal studies at coming all the way from New York, NYU, and works on transnational feminism with a particular focus on Bangladesh. We have all the way from Argentina, Buenos Aires, Maria Adela Antocoletz, who's a human rights activist and vice secretary of Las Madres de la Plaza de Mayo, and who's the secretary of FEDEFAM and also the president of the International Coalition Against Enforced Disappearances. Last but not least, we have Mona Anis, who is senior editorial consultant and former deputy editor of Ahram Weekly. Mona also participated in the 2011 revolution in Egypt, which has a very special place for my heart. And happy birthday, Sana Hilwa Ya Gamil. So, special day. I also want to quickly give special thanks to the masterminds behind this event. So we have Leila Suleiman, of course, Lama Shoufani. Thank you, and the support of the NYUAD Institute. Special thanks to Nahed Ahmed, Tariq Shihab, among others, the technical team. So now, let's start telling you about the format, so you have a heads up. We'll have about an hour for a panel discussion, in which we'll explore the past, present, future of motherhood in the public space. So this is our topic. And we'll open the floor for questions from the audience. So let's start. Now I'll give you a couple minutes to tell us a bit more about yourselves. All right, Dina.
Okay, thank you. Hello. It's on. Okay. Thank you so much, Z. I'm going to give a formal introduction, short formal introduction first. I am trained as a cultural anthropologist. Is this echoing? No. Okay. I'm trained, yeah, okay, but my work is very interdisciplinary. I'm trying to put into conversation transnational feminist theories with the anthropology of Islam and labor, but also joining it with critical development studies with the emphasis on critical, because I grew up, and my work is on Bangladesh, which is a very transnational space in which I think, which is steeped in a deeply problematic developmental discourse and liberal theories of women's empowerment. And I've grown up wanting to push back against certain discourses. And I really believe, I have a lot of students here, which is wonderful, but I really believe that social justice work, among other things, calls for dislodging dominant stories about the way we understand the world. And I don't mean just adding another story. It's not about, you know, not having a single story and having multiple stories, but like challenging the way we understand the world. So thinking, demystifying and denaturalizing, among other things, motherhood and what counts as a woman's issue, which means I often write out of feminist rage, or just rage about the way in which things I am familiar with are being represented. So that's part of, you know, what I bring, I think, to this panel. I'm very much at home, most at home in academia, but I'm also very committed to try and connect feminist theory to practice. And I'm quite not exactly involved close to the women's movement in Bangladesh. So I've worked with, not for, a lot of legal aid and feminist NGOs. And as the students from my J term who went to Bangladesh with me will know, it's a way for me to think about how development and women's development is unfolding in these places. My latest sort of publication, which happens to be on child marriage, it's really about how discourses of child marriage and motherhood circulate in the world. Finally, a little biographical note. I grew up in a very middle-class family. Both my parents were professors. They were not big names at all in the public sphere, but both my parents were very, I grew up in a very quote-unquote secular and a very religious household. So my father was a Qurane Hafiz. He came from a family of Sufi peers. He was next in line. He didn't do it. He went to a madrasa. So I grew up without ever, at least inside my home, confronting any kind of gender inequality, which means that I've grown up without a hostility toward religion, particularly toward Islam, that I found missing in my peers. My peers tended to, I have a very different relationship to religion. That's not where I've ever thought inequality lay for me. And that's very much part of my biography.
All right, thank you so much. Mona, wanna go?
Hello, good evening. First, I'd like to thank the organizers for this fantastic, really amazingly nice gathering in few days away from the maddening crowd, in every sense of the word, you know, sort of literally and figuratively. This was just something in between all the madness of the word. By training, I did a degree of English language and literature, went to England, did sociology of literature as master's, and did a second master's in discourse analysis with Ernesto Laclau, and was a PhD student and a teaching assistant for probably for the first 15 years of my stay in England, or the 15 years I stayed in England between 74 and 90. In the year 90, being a single mother and living in the most expensive city in the world, I decided to go back to Egypt to rest, basically, because, you know, I thought I want to have a family and have a car and not just sort of, you know, take three transports between underground and buses with a buggy and go down and up and walk and, you know, I mean, sort of my daughter was at that time, she was 3 or 4. And then I never went back to England. I kept for a couple of years paying my continuation fees in the hope to sort of submit my PhD, but I didn't do that. And a complete career shift, I went into journalism. I have to admit, I've always been a bit of a jack of all trades. You know the rest of it, you know, master of none, perhaps. And I wrote on many things. I was a war correspondent. I was a literary critic. I went to England to join RADA, and they wouldn't have me, because they said I was too old and I had to be trained before that. So I loved theater, but I never did anything other than watching plays, loved literature, wrote about it. So, but I mean, all this has to do with my background and my parents, especially my parents, and yes, I'm speaking about my mother, but also I have to mention my father. I come from a secular, indeed a communist family of Egyptian communists in the 40s, who entered communism through national liberation struggle and, you know, sort of fighting against the British. They are typical middle class, clever people who went to School of Science, the Polytechnic of Egypt, and which was the breeding ground also for communists, you know. I mean, sort of, and for the first 6 years of my life, they were studying in England. So I lived with them for the first 6 years of my life. Actually, my father's career in England, he was, by then he had, he's a brilliant mathematician, you know, and he had his PhD from the Imperial College, and he was teaching at the Imperial College when the Suez War came, and he decided to resign from London University and to campaign against the Suez War. And in November, sort of first or second, I can't remember, there was the biggest post-Second World War demonstration in London, in Trafalgar Square, and my father was one of the people who addressed the meeting. It was organized by the Labour Party, something called the Liberation of the Colonies Movement, Communist Party, and actually they managed to sort of, not to stop the war, but to restrain Eden, and Eden had to, because those were the conservatives at that time. We returned on the following day of my father, and my father was campaigning for the previous 2 months in various cities in the UK. His friend said, you have to leave immediately before you are served with a deportation writ, at which point you will not be able to come back again. So in 48 hours, we left England, not to Egypt, to Khartoum, because there were no flights to Egypt. I was 6, and this moment, it's the first time I try to remember, you know, what sort of rupture that made in my life. So, I mean, we came back to Egypt. My father would be denied his opportunity to teach at Cairo University, his university. So he works as a journalist. My mother, who hadn't finished her PhD, because she was also a mother, worked as a chemistry teacher. Then, in 57, this was a year full of hopes in Egypt, hopes that were very quickly dashed. My father ran for the first parliamentary election in the Republic, and the elections were rigged in a very obvious way. He had a runoff and he had so many supporters, but it was rigged. My mother, women were allowed to vote with the constitution of 56 and the elections of 57 for the first time. My mother sort of campaigned and enlisted women to register. And then all this comes to a very bad sort of end by the end of 58. My father goes to concentration camp for 6 years. My mother, afraid of, they were divorced by then, afraid that they might put her in jail, decides to sort of post herself in the provinces and shifts her focus from political activism to building institutions, education institutions, as a teacher and as a head teacher, and she spent her life doing this, opening or extending education for women. So from this background, it was natural that I, whenever there was any political movement or political activism or anything, I definitely joined. I can talk at the end, you know, about the Arab Spring and how I participated. But before that, I was active in the student movement of 71 and 72, and I went to prison for 4 months or something, which wasn't a very bad prison or something. Nothing like now or what my father saw in concentration camps. Well, thank you.
Thank you. Maria Adela.
Thank you, Zainab. Thank you very much. And thank you. Thanks to the Institute and to the university that have made me stay here, my presence here. I owe that to them. Thanks to dear Laila and to Lama. They have arranged everything. Thanks to you. Thanks to my friend Marie-Andre, who is accompanying me, because she's an interpreter. She's studying here. I am English is not my language, and you will prove it quite soon. And thanks to my dear friend, Professor Ram Natarajan, I am here because of him also. I chose to make a presentation of three persons. Not so much as to myself, on myself. I'm a professor in literature, and I have traveled a lot, but because of duties that ought to be done concerning the defense of human rights, and I belong to the association. At first it was a movement, afterwards it was an association of the mothers, of Plaza de Mayo. I'm a sister, and I say that I'm not alone here. In addition to my companions, when a person appears, when a person is present, that person is not alone. My identity involves others, other identities. I am here, but my mother is here also, because my identity has a part of her. My brother, my only brother, who is Daniel, who is an enforced disappeared, he's also here. So I feel in company, I feel myself in the middle of a family. So I say something of my mother. My mother, Maria Adela was her name. She was raised with her sisters and her brother in a very conservative city in the northern part of province of Buenos Aires, the city of San Nicolás, it was. She married a diplomat, and my father was a diplomat. They separated several years later. In her city, when she returns with me and with Daniel, my brother, she faces the difficult situation of being a separated woman. It was not so common in 49, in that city and that in that condition. But she started working in the judicial in trials and as a functionary, judicial functionary, and she triumphs. She triumphs, and she could make her place in San Nicolás. Concerning the search of my brother, for my disappeared brother and the others, she was very respectful to me. It was not so common. Some mothers almost opt to oblige to forget the other children because they were desperate looking for the disappeared one. I have the proofs of that. It was not my case, she never forced me to follow her, but I followed her. She never she never abandoned me. We looked for Daniel together. We have been to public events and have even spoken to the public together. She had a natural authority without any authoritarianism. And Daniel Antokolis, my only brother, he was a professor, an expert in public international law. She was a left-wing militant, and he became closer to the national and popular movement. She was detained and disappeared in November 1976 until today. And afterwards, I can speak on the movement of the mothers, no?
Okay, thank you. Thank you so much. And I think we see here that with you know, one's biography, the choices made in a life are a result of historical shifts, right? Family settings, political changes. So it's really great to have these perspectives. Now, maybe trying to go to part of your experiences where the activism started, right? So the now the journey with the how motherhood comes into public space. Maria Della, if you wanna.
Oh, what a suffering, pain, happiness at the same time. Every event in our life is that two faces, two feelings together forever. The mothers were born in the midst of a civil military dictatorship. It was a dictatorship. It is hard for young people to imagine in Argentina what was the position of the mothers, what was the fact of being a group of mothers in the middle of the Plaza de Mayo, when we were living in a country where even a leaf didn't move without the military authority making it move. Everything was without movement, but the mothers gathered. They started being a group in the middle of strongly established maternal roles also. Even their husbands were surprised. They were very surprised when the movement started growing and was more firm every time, every Thursday. They were supposed to stay at home and to raise children. Their objective was to find their children, victims of enforced disappearance. In April 1977, 14 mothers joined in Plaza de Mayo. Plaza de Mayo, I don't know if you have visited Argentina and Buenos Aires. Plaza de Mayo is the main of the squares in my country, but it is not. The single square. Mothers and events are everywhere in the territory of in the land of my country. But Plaza de Mayo is the core. It's where history boils every day, and it is the most important open space there. They were the only thing that moved there. They became raising awareness of some things. For example, they understood that they had to search not only their own child, but other childs, the children of the other companions. The leaders appeared, the specialists in different actions, for example, those mothers who were writers, those who made trips to introduce denounces, those who went to the newspapers, those who knew how to complain in front of the authorities. They understood, they slowly understood, the most of them, why their children were disappearing. They understood there was a plan, there was a very careful plan of disappearance. And they understood that the missing children were not Argentine, and that the mothers started understanding also what the children were looking for, what were their objectives. Some of the mothers knew that, the most of them didn't know. At first, the dictatorship let them grow. Somebody from the Casa Rosada, from the Pink House, the House of Government, called them crazy. And that name increased the crazy of Plaza de Mayo, and the mothers adopted it. Yes, we are crazy, but because of pain. Yes, we are crazy. That was contradiction, no? Contradiction in a country who where everything was crazy except them, perhaps. But soon after, they began to the dictatorship began to repress the mothers always. Despite their fear, they had courage. For example, 7 months after the mothers, the apparition of the movement, its leader Azucena was kidnapped and disappeared forever. I always think in the next Thursday, in the Plaza de Mayo, they are where they going? Where they trying not to go? They went. They went, and that was her triumph. They made that movement, that being there, made them invincible. Their white scarf crossed the borders of the world, and the scarf that is their symbol was known all over the world. I have the desire to put my scarf. The scarf is the symbol of the disappeared. My mother held the position of have every person using the scarf, even men, because each scarf means disappearance, and each scarf means a special disappearance, not a special, but a single disappeared. So I can put it even if I'm not a mother.
No? I may put it like this, as they do. I'm comfortable with the handkerchief. So we can also speak on the consequences of the movement, no? That I think there are a lot of them.
Muchas gracias.
Thank you.
Mona, you already told us, started on the first question, so maybe if you can tell us about your mother's activism. Thank you.
Yeah, I'd love to pick from there. Of course, I'm interested of the...
Yes.
Oh, sorry. Fast forward from the 1940s and 50s, and this is my mother, by the way, in the Afro-Asian Solidarity Conference hosted by Egypt in 75. This is immediately after she arrived from London. And next to her is another famous Egyptian painter, N.G. Aflatoon. And of course, those are two Asian guests in the Afro-Asian, I guess from Sri Lanka and somewhere else. And it's a picture I found. So between, I think I reached with you when my father was quite central until he went to a concentration camp on the New Year's Eve of 58-59. My mother, from that moment onward until my father came out, that's like in my age between 18 and 14, I was not only brought by my mother, but my mother and her mothers. I grew up with her mother was a widow at the age of 28, and my mother was a divorcee at the age of 35. So I was brought up by single women for the most important period of my life, and that's between 8 and 14 years old when my father came out, and then he became again in the picture. I'm saying this because I find it very, my mother didn't, those were years of political suppression until perhaps the mid-60s when people came out of prison and when Nasser was trying to create a more space for those he sort of put in jail before, and some of them collaborated on many of the populist and very popular projects of Nasser at that time and wrote in favor of the regime. So that very strong anonymity between Nasser and the left had sort of dissipated by the mid-60s. And during that period, all that period from 59 till the mid-60s, my mother had concentrated on sort of being an educator, teaching and extending education for women to very far remote places in the provinces. And I really sort of hated that at the time I was 8 and 9, because I didn't really understand why to take me away from the city and from the elitist kind of school I used to be and just put me in a village with no electricity, with no waters. Years later, I said, thanks, mommy, because I was a stranger in my society and very middle class, upper middle class. And those years, 6, 7 years, which I was very angry, you know, because of, I mean, sort of had really transformed me into a different person. And this is, I think it was not by being the political leader that my father was and remained to be until his death, but by being a steady and continuous influence on, you know, I mean, sort of really understanding the problems of Egypt, working for the people, empathizing with the oppressed and understanding, you know, I mean, that this is not a rich country and this is not England and, you know, I mean, wake up. You're not the sheltered child who cannot speak Arabic. No, you are an Egyptian. This, I feel, and my granny also has been, being lucky to have an educated granny, her mother. Those two mothers, I mean, sort of have influenced me the most. And I mean, sort of, I would love one day to sort of look in depth at the trials and tribulations of single mothers. I myself have was a single mother for a good 25, 30 years until my daughter married and became an independent career woman. But it's too difficult and too variegated and too painful, because you really, I don't have the energy now, and I couldn't write this. I just wanted to say that by the 1967 sort of defeat of the Egyptian, of the combined Arab armies, my mother became very active in the union, in her union, which is the biggest union in Egypt. They have 6 million teachers in that teachers' union, in giving lectures and in hosting meetings for revolutionary singers, Sheikh Imam and Ahmed Fuad Nigm, singing in sort of meetings of the union, sometimes even in schools. And I think after the defeat, there was a very sort of, there are 2-3 years where Nasser had discovered, you know, that this defeat had made the people awake to so many things, and that he had to open the margin a lot more than it was. So, like, I was a student at that time in university, or I entered university in 68. They abolished the police guards inside campuses. They allowed lots of leftist magazines and publications, and the left are very good, the left members are very good when there is a nationalist cause or something. I mean, they shine really, you know, I mean, sort of the third word. So both my parents at that point, and I guess me, I demonstrated beginning from 68 until 72 when I graduated, and the last time I was a member of the student union and all these things, I mean, sort of, and finally when Nasser died and Sadat came to power and started really shifting to another completely different direction that we didn't like at that time, students and generally, the thing that resulted in the open air policy and in the sort of alliance with America and all that. So we occupied the university demanding something or another. And in this occupation, that was the beginning of really dealing rough with students again. So, I mean, I went to prison at that time. And when I went to England after I finished, I was always a member of the Arab Student Union, Arab Union of Union of Arab Students in Great Britain and Ireland. I was on the executive committee. I sort of went for meetings. Of course, I have been since I became politically active. I am a pro-Palestinian and worked in the camps and worked sort of among Palestinians at the time of Beirut, when they were still in Beirut. So most of our activism abroad was centered around this until I came back in 90. And then maybe we can move to Tahrir Square and the last segment.
Okay, thank you. So, Dina, if you want to...
Very hard to follow up on those two things. I have no stories about the kind of activism that you two have done. And I thought what I would do is prepare this question on describing my scholarly or activist journey with motherhood and public spaces, which is sort of what I thought about. And this is where I want to begin by thanking Leila and Lama for inviting me to this conference, because frankly, I hadn't ever really reflected on motherhood academically or even as an activist. And so this has been incredibly generative, which hopefully by, you know, in the next question we'll get to. So I did accept this invitation with a little bit of hesitation, wondering what I would do. It's been, as I say, it's been different, and I'm really glad I came. It's been wonderful. I don't, but if you've been following my comments, you know, if you've been around in the last couple of days, I don't want to be a feminist killjoy, to use Sarah Ahmed's very provocative and very useful term, but I'm wary of the concept of motherhood itself, at least the way in which it's generally used. And it's very much the individual woman, and it's motherhood as birthing, as biological, and I think it doesn't speak to me, perhaps. I find it very essentializing analytically and in real life, and it valorizes a very heteropatriarchal vision of womanhood, I think. So for me, in that sense, you know, motherhood is not an innocent concept that we can think about. It's a capacious category, though, as you know, we'll see. And it's a very political category. And I think it really shows how the political is personal, not the personal is political. And I'm not the first person to say this, but how the political shapes our personal lives is something I think motherhood is another way to think about that. So what I want to do for the next 3 minutes is a talk, or in the rest of the session, is to think about the ideological work of motherhood as a trope, as it circulates in popular culture, but as it circulates globally in different sites, right? What does it do? Since we were asked to think a little bit about the past, I want, as a post-colonial subject, I think, when I think of motherhood, I think of the nation, the newly decolonized nation, right? And I think many of you, I think you were talking about this, about Mother India. You were going to, I didn't, you know. So the idea of the nation as mother is a very, you know, is a trope that is, again, very generative, and it's been used. And if you have, any of you have seen the film Mother India, or the posters of it, there's Nargis Dutt with a, you know, what is it called, langur? A plow, thank you. A plow, she's plowing the field. This is the moment at which, after independence, you have the woman bodily sort of building the nation, quite literally, in the absence of men and various other things. And so that's a particular moment. But I want to then shift to questions of who is allowed to be the mother who can build the nation. And here's where I want to shift to the history of Bangladesh, for instance. So in 1971, there was a war, I don't know, the War of Independence that led to the emergence of Bangladesh also involved mass rapes of women and girls. It was a little bit like the rapes of Bosnian women by the Serbs. So they were rape camps, really, where women were held, and a lot of women became pregnant. After the war, the government, unlike the governments of Pakistan and India in 1947, the government didn't reject or silence the raped women. They were enfolded into the nation as daughters of the nation through this term that the prime minister of the time, or the so-called father of the nation, Mujib, used, a birangona, which means war heroine. Actually, it wasn't Mujib who first coined it, but never mind. But it's a very interesting idea to say these women who have been raped have not been dishonored, right? They are part of the nation, but... And it was a very double-edged thing in many ways, which we don't need to talk about. What is interesting is the way in which these women who had been raped, and many of whom were pregnant, they were not allowed to go through with their pregnancy, or if it was too late for them to have their pregnancies aborted, their children were forcibly taken away from them, with or without the mother's consent, basically, and they were adopted they were put up for adoption into places like, you know, Sweden and elsewhere, okay? So there's, I think this is a really interesting way to think about how motherhood, who can be a mother, how motherhood is nationalized, but it's through particular ideas of race and blood and purity. And these women basically had what I think of as failed motherhood, right? That's, do I have a little bit more time?
A few seconds. Yeah.
Okay, or I can talk about this later, because I also do think that motherhood affords a certain kind of protection. So you can go into public spaces as mothers when other people can't do it, which is why, you know, so of course the space in Argentina is sort of iconic that we all think about, but everywhere from occupied or colonized Kashmir to actually right now in Bangladesh, mothers have been on the streets or continue to be on the streets fighting for their disappeared children. Right? Yeah. And it's so motherhood is this space that you can use strategically. In order to put in certain kind of political demands, I just will say, but it does, it's not necessarily unifying. So I was just reading up before I came on these protests in Sri Lanka, in during the Sri Lankan civil war, there was a mother's front in the north, a Tamil mother's front, and there was also, for other reasons, a Sinhala Buddhist, I guess, mother's front, but these two mother's front, even in the same country, did not speak to each other. They were still riven by these ethnic conflicts, you know, it's identity. So motherhood, again, as I said, is not just political, but it's also, it doesn't necessarily unify. It's not innocent in any way.
Thank you so much. And I mean, I love how we started with mothers as superheroes to mothers and how we also subvert this concept, right?
Yeah.
So thank you so much. For this part, so I'm going to change a little. So please bear with me if we can combine the two last questions. So if you can tell us about both sort of this instrumentalization, right, of motherhood, but also if we can have concluding remarks on maybe, you know, the reflecting, right, on how we can think about this in the future. So...
I remember Mona saying, wherever there is a repression, there appears a group of mothers. That is true. So what happened with the mothers, with Argentine mothers, no? But mothers are everywhere. Mothers fighting for their rights are everywhere. They are everywhere. I try to make a synthesis. Biological mothers in their kitchen and in the street and on the street. The Argentine ones were a surprise for their husbands and for the dictatorship and for society. Also, the essential thing. Essential. That word is. Polemical. The issue that identified that movement is that they maintained their role and transferred their role with activism. The way they appeared under the public light was the new, was the unknown. The unknown role of the mothers. They socialized motherhood, and they went to the plaza, but they remain mothers as in the kitchen, as at home. They remain being biological mothers. They didn't assume other roles. They remained as just the mothers whose womb was broken, was wide, no? Was broken. They continue the... they just translated the private into the public. There has been, and there goes on being, a lot of theses and studies on that. My friend Ram and the Argentine here probably know that researchers visit them so as to to try to write on their special condition of continuing being biological mothers in the public light, in the public fight. And they have influenced in society. I don't know if I'm responding the questions. Governments pass, but the mothers remain. They are symbol of human rights. There is a machismo in Argentina, but perhaps not so strong and wide as in other countries, even in other countries, in other American countries, no? The mothers have influenced other mothers of the world. We know that those marches with the handkerchiefs in different with different colors, and they have also influenced the formidable, the huge Argentine movement, the feminist movement. The feminist adopted a symbol in Argentina, and that symbol is a green handkerchief. So sometimes we see, well, some, there are mothers with the white and the green handkerchief using them at the same time. There is no a huge demonstration, a feminist demonstration in Buenos Aires without a mother who ends the demonstration speaking to the public. And there are many drawings with both handkerchiefs. The one of the mothers, the white one for the mothers and the green one for the feminist colleagues. I consider that there should be another meeting, there should be a meeting of a week speaking on how the movements influenced each other, how the feminist, and not feminist movement, the movements of women in the world have been influenced by each other, no? I don't know if I have finished with with your questions. And
thank you so much.
Thank you to you.
Well, I mean, I have a very difficult, because if I want to really speak, I mean, I agree with Dina completely about that motherhood is not an innocent notion. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. But what is? Anything that lends itself to interpolation by the powers that be or by ideological state apparatuses is sort of not innocent. I mean, sort of, a very nice mother like my mother, or a very nasty mother like a mother who throws her children in the street and whatever, I mean, sort of, can be both used to, I mean, sort of, denote different things. So other than that, the kind of the visceral relationship, and what's more visceral than an umbilical cord, you know, I mean, sort of that the moment of beginning, I mean, sort of, other than that, everything is subject to social conditions and to situations and things. I had wanted to look at some of the interpolations and some of the sort of, I don't want to look at representations because I mean sort of you have, but I mean sort of, and subversion even. And those things, I mean sort of, can happen through, by a very wicked intent, you know, or also happens in art and literature. And art and literature, you can do anything because you probe people to think. basically, more than anything, I'm in sort of, if I think of subverting the notion of mother, I can think of no one better than probably two, Salman Rushdie and Alma Dovar. I mean, sort of course, the very famous film All About My Mother, when his father, I mean, becomes a mother and the mother becomes the bearer of, and you just come out of Almodovar films thinking many things, and that's the beauty of art and literature. Salman Rushdie, I have a very special affinity to, because I consider myself one of the midnight children of his first novel. For those who don't know the novel, the midnight children were the children who were born at the stroke of the hour of Indian independence, ushering in the independence of the ex-colonies from. I've always affiliated with that, considered myself, you know, I mean, sort of, I was born the beginning of 51, but then our revolution or our coup, depending on how you look at it, I mean, sort of, was in July 52. And I mean, sort of, I was rather, yani, so amazed at that world he weaved into that novel of all these children, you know, being able to communicate with each other by telepathy, and I really wanted to be one of them. I thought, oh my God, wouldn't it be nice if we all, and then subverting, and this is more, the notion of the mother, the nation as a mother. Of course, the nation as a mother, I mean, sort of, there is Mother India, Nargis in her 50s film, who, by the way, kills her son because he is a traitor to the nation. So she kills him. There is Nargis. I guess I read in somewhere that also Gandhi's wife was considered a mother of the nation. Definitely, I mean, sort of, in our case, the leader of the nationalist movement in Egypt, Saad Zaghloul, his wife was called the mother of Egyptians, Umm al-Masriyin. He takes all these notions and makes this time Indira Gandhi the mother of India, and she castrates all men. You know, I mean, of course, this is a reference to her family planning campaign or something, but, you know, I mean, and fast forward, we come to an amazing novel, which is The Moor's Last Sigh. I mean, in that novel, which is a comment on everything, of course, on mother, because his mother is the mother of the national independence, the greatest painter, the multicultural, you know, woman having this empire in Bombay, the multicultural. And then, I mean, sort of, he has a very problematic relation with the mother, because there comes in a lover who really wants to pollute this relation or something. And then we get into an audible thing about, you know, him, would he sleep with his mother or not? Would his mother paint him? I don't know what. And it is such a rich world, which of course he ends by exploding the whole of Bombay, and he doesn't like call it Mumbai. He calls it Bombay. This cosmopolitan thing, it's all sort of brought to demolition at the end by that lover of him and other people. Those are, you know, more sort of, this is, and this kind of free play, what the Derrida calls free play, you know, I mean, is very legitimate in art and in literature, but also the very conventional mother, Maxim Gorky's mother, you know, the mother of, and he was writing his mother in 1905, with the defeat of the revolution of 1905 and not after 1907, but the mother who takes the whole country, you know, in her bosom and who distributes leaflets and who organizes workers and things. This is also a beautiful mother. And we have seen, I at least know of some stories like that. I know it from my mother or from my grandmother who was also participated in the 1919 revolution. I'm sort of, so there are many, and of course there are as many shadows as there are mothers.
Yeah.
So I mean sort of that itself, I admire my mother. I don't think that my daughter admires me the same way that I admire my, maybe because I'm a midnight child that sort of grow up on the national liberation and things. My daughter thinks my daughter is very much into, and she, my daughter is a feminist, is an environmentalist, is, I mean, sort of like she wouldn't have a leather bag, let alone taking my ivory necklace or anything. I mean, that's a big, big thing. And she is, of course, pro-gay and pro-rainbow and thing. I mean, sort of, okay. I mean, that is, I think there is also a generational aspect in all this. How you were brought up, how you came, and moments of defeat, we are. I mean, sort of, yani, my daughter looks to me and says, and what did you do? And she's probably right. Yani, I, with Allen Ginsberg, I say, I saw the best of my generations sort of crying mad in the streets. And yes, I have 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 friends who committed suicide, who went mad, who have been sectioned in asylums. And that was a moment when, you know, I mean, the dreams we had were never achieved. And yes, but maybe in another sort of generation, another period, I mean, people would be proud of their mothers. I don't know.
Thank you. And we have her. We can bring her to the room. We have a picture of her.
And you mean my daughter?
Yes, right?
Yeah. Actually,
yes, there she is.
My daughter, when she was 3, we were at Hyde Park demonstrating. That's me.
Yeah.
Demonstrating one of the South Africa solidarity things.
Yeah.
And she's carrying a flag saying Free Nelson Mandela, aww, but she's having her Dumbo also. And until today, when she's 40, she says, what mother is that that takes her children to demonstrations?
Well, so, you wait and see the one picture you have, I have.
Okay.
Yes.
So, Dina, there you go.
Sorry, yes. This mother has taken her daughter everywhere.
Yes.
As a duty,
yes.
As my duty as a mother. Yeah,
yeah,
anyway.
Yeah, but sometimes it
right. So I'm going, you're very poetic. I'm going to be very prosaic here about, you know, weaponizing motherhood, you know, what to do. I'm just like that. I want to think about, I was thinking about Bangladesh, and we were, you know, I was thinking in terms of past, present, and future. So in the present, I see there's been a real shift since nationalism. So the gaze was on the middle-class woman's body and the middle class woman and during the nationalist movement, you know, middle class women raising proper middle class girl citizens who would know how to sing and dance and dress in a particular Bengali secular kind of way. That's really shifted. And it's been, what is interesting is how transnational capital, the role of transnational capital has intensified a different kind of gaze. You know, the nationalist gaze is today a developmentalist gaze, and it's on the working class woman's body, right? The middle class woman has done her job, but, you know, everybody is invested in how this working class body will work or not, right? And so in the last two, and I think and it is because of that early conversation we had with the three of us, and I was thinking, and I thought, remember that hunger strike? I thought of it. So I actually, it's that conversation with you that I'm saying that has been so generative to me, because I've started to, with the two of you, that I started to think of motherhood being neoliberalized. And I think it's a global phenomenon. It's not just Bangladesh, it's not just the global South. I can talk, I have lots of stuff on the US if I have time. I have a feeling I won't have time. But this is the memory, the photos there, I'll explain it in a minute. But first of all, and this got me thinking about how the iconic image of the Bangladeshi garment worker is of a young woman behind a machine. She's unencumbered by the obligations of motherhood. She might be working to support herself or her parents out of poverty. She might be working to collect money to get married, but there's never any real children in the background, even though half of Bangladeshi garment workers are actually married and have children generally. So it's a really interesting way in which to think about what circulates as the iconic image. And keeping motherhood in the shadows, I think, is very convenient for the neoliberal state and for transnational capital, because what the state is doing is basically saying, you know, I'll come to that. But anyway, so that's what I was thinking. So an image from 10 years ago popped to my mind, and this is the image you see. This is a hunger strike that several hundred workers took on. The strike was several hundred workers. There were 15 women or so who were on hunger strike, and I went along. My daughter is in that picture looking, she's there in the blue looking she was very distraught, quite traumatized. As well, I wanted her to know what it was like. And I think today she's happy that I took her. All right, she's there in a lot of these pictures, but I took her because she should know. And in those days, she listened to me. I could take her. Okay, she's 24 now, I can't take her anywhere. Okay, yeah. But several things about this, unlike the spectacular violence on the bodies of mothers and others in the Rana Plaza factory collapse, which the whole world covered and knew about. This was 1 year after Rana Plaza. There was not a single international story on this. It was very interesting because this is slow violence. It doesn't have any cachet in that sense. And I was one of the very few people who's written about this sort of in the, I just happened to be there, but in the public sphere. I'm there, and when I was talking to this happened, I was talking to this woman when she got a phone call, and it was her mother-in-law saying, kind of harassing her, like, how long are you going to be doing this? We need the money. They were on strike because they hadn't been paid for 3 months, which means, and these people do not get paid living wages, they don't have any savings. Which means that she was really worried about her children's school fees, how she would pay for the school fees. She kept saying over and over, and I'm not sure my mother-in-law, I don't know if she'll even want me if I'm not earning. Well, she had a whole bunch of things. You know, at that time, I didn't think I would write about it, which I have later, so I was just listening. So I have no notes, this is all from my memory. What is interesting, what it seemed to me later as I was thinking about motherhood, and I've written about the strike in a very different context without the motherhood thing, is how with neoliberalization and structural adjustment, the state has shifted all of responsibility onto the individual. We always hear about it, but it's become the mother's duty to make sure that she has the money for her children to go to school. And there's been a shifting, we know what neoliberal ideologies and structural adjustment do, but there's been a real shifting of responsibility. Again, we also know that, but liberal feminist discourses of empowerment that talk about the Bangladeshi worker as being, now she's empowered enough to pay for her children's school fees, actually covers over, does a lot, is actually quite complicit in individualizing the burden, taking away any state responsibility, and also about the transnational capital not having to pay as much as it should, because these are not women, they don't need living wages, is the idea. Right, so they cheapen the labor through these, but it is these ideologies of empowerment, if they are sort of free-floating, global, you know, they can be very, very destructive, is what I was thinking. Do I have any time? No time. Okay, I had much more to say, but I'll save it.
Thank you so much, you. And I'm really sorry for keeping time, but this was great. So, I mean, so many key takeaways. I mean, motherhood is not just the biology, the sacrality. It's challenging politics. It's being maybe challenged by future generations, by other ideas. But I think it's also very good here to see how we need to accept, recognize the ambivalence of motherhood as a concept. So please help me.
You've been listening to a download from the NYU Abu Dhabi Institute. You'll find more information on our website, www.nyuad.nyu.edu/institute.